session number 27226, Reel 7.
The hook, Reel 7. All right. We've got to the stage now where we can nearly go solo. And that is an interesting exercise because you go up and do a run with your instructor, and you do all the things you've been doing, and then he says, well, this is the day, we're going to go solo, takes you up, does exactly the normal exercise, comes back down and says, there you are, well, off you go, Gordon, and have a go yourself. And straight away you're in the aircraft, you're familiar with it, you're sitting in the back seat, you don't have an instructor in front of you, which makes it visually a little better. So you go up and you just do a simple solo, and your first solo is 10 minutes. No more than that. You just go on, take off, fly around, do a circuit, come back and land. Period. Okay? Once you've done that, on the same day, you and probably immediately after that, you go off with your instructor for a half an hour's flight, flying around, doing all the things you've done before, until you go for your next solo, which is usually on the same day, where you go up and do all these things again, but just for a little longer. You do a takeoff, fly around for about 35 minutes, I flew for about half an hour, and come back and land, and then that's almost a day's work. I don't think we did any more that day. Oh, yes, I did. I went off again with instructions, doing low flying, which was, again, not part of your ab initio exercise, but this is a development of flying generally. Okay, so low flying is something that you have to be shown and taught and learn, because suddenly the relationship between the aircraft and the ground has changed radically. The fact that you're so close to the ground on low flying is that your visual acuity is related to the ground around you rather than the airspeed indicator, which is the thing that keeps you flying in the air. And this is one of the things you have to learn, and which I've dealt with already in a casual passage. Looking at it again, I spend the next day or three or four, let's look at it all here, doing with myself, doing normal exercises, and then go up and do spinning by myself, a spinning exercise. After a trip with my instructor, then I go off for another day where the instructor sets me off in the day. The next day he sets me off. The next day I go off by myself, doing spinning and side slipping. And that's one way of coming into the approach, because if your approach is high, you can't. The higher you are, the more runway you're going to use. So you want to control your position by getting rid of your position in the air. And you do this by side-slipping. And it's a very interesting little exercise, and right, very, very satisfying. Because you're going in, you're coming into land over your critical airspeed, or your stalling speed, with about 10 miles, I should say, 10 miles an hour, I would think, with Tiger Moths. Yeah, that's about that, over the critical speed. And you're going towards the straight in line with the runway, but you're too high. So all you do is drop your left wing by putting a stick over to the left. That means your ailerons are turning it, the aircraft rotationally. And then you put on top rudder, which means instead of turning, you're holding the aircraft in the same line, but you're slipping through the air sideways. And you can do that either way, a very simple maneuver. You can do it quite coarsely, you just slam it over to the right, put top rudder, and you go, this out, you control it very quickly, just put everything back to the central and back again. And that is one way you'll see biplane pilots do this quite a lot, because it's very comforting to go in and you just say, well, I want to hit that spot, shh, 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 bonk. And it's very satisfying. And that's one way that you control your actual landing ultimately. Because you can never, it's not like a major aircraft, a civil aircraft, which will take probably 5 miles to process on a straight line, coming down a straight route and then hit and bonk. He's always at the right height, at the right level to hit the airfield at the right place. Okay, so that deals with that. We then get to the next development, which we haven't really touched on, is the practicality of doing technique. The speed of steep turns. Now, you've already done turns, the medium turns, which is merely turning from going straight to turning left by putting in the rudder, keeping the nose level, going round and round, just nice and gently, to a situation where you want to turn rather quickly. And in order to do this, you need to maintain as much power as you can. In order to do a really steep turn, you do this at high level because inevitably you're going to hit a stall if you're doing it properly to the limit. You turn in and put your left wing right down to it till it's nearly at vertical, and you hold back on your stick. So you're holding back on the elevator in a different sense. In other words, you're going round the curve. Now, in order to do that, under normal circumstances, if you did that, you'd fall out of the sky. So you keep the aircraft flying by plenty of power and top rudder. Okay? So you've gone into the thing, you're hauling back to go around the corner on your stick tight, and you're keeping your line of the horizon, if you want to, by using your rudder, by applying top rudder. So you pull back and go all the way around. Now, the tighter you pull, the more load there is on the wings, the more likely you are to stall. And when you stall, it's a gentle thing in a biplane. In a monoplane, it's vicious. You hit the stall and it goes the other way into a spin immediately because you have no airspeed. You're in a situation where the aircraft is stalling. It's going to come out of the stall by dropping the nose down. Okay, you're in rudder and everything else. You just centralize everything, come down, maintain high airspeed, and get back again. Now, arising out of this and steep turns, it's rather interesting because later on, you live in fighter aircraft, you lived in steep turns, and that's quite simple, no problem, but you're stalling all the time, and it's a good tactical exercise. But I am now flying an aircraft myself. I've been flying something of the order of 13 hours. I've done spinning. I know how to fly an aircraft now, how to control it, how to get out of problems. But in the old days, First World War pilots, Biglers and all that crowd, when they'd flown about 12 hours, they considered themselves pilots. And one of the things pilots always did was to loop a loop, do the loop. Now, looping is a very, very simple thing. It varies from tiger moths, where you pull up, go over the top and back, and that's just a haul back on the stick over the top and down, to a situation where in a high-powered jet aircraft, you fly around the circle. You fly all the way around and come back again. The power is there to take you all the way up and all the way around in a very, very big circle. When you're doing a steep turn, you're actually doing a loop in the level sense, all with its characteristics of stalling and everything else. So now we're in a situation where I don't know anything at all about flying really, but I'm flying an aircraft and think, well, people used to fly aircraft and they used to do loops. And I've done one with the instructor. I'll do one myself. So I went up very high in a little bit of my spare time and stuffed the nose down to get a speed of about 85 knots, which was high speed in a Tiger Moth. I thought, well, we do a loop, and I've got the throttle wide open. I'm trying to get 85 knots out of it. I pull the stick back, okay? And I, because I thought I've got the speed, I pull the throttle back as well. I went up and got onto the top. And I remember it very painfully because a Tiger Moth has a petrol tank on the top of the wing. And I went over the top and I flopped out and stalled. And the petrol was coming out of the vapour, you know, vapour was coming out of the vent at the top. And I got back into a simple routine of flying a bit fast, going downwards, pull the aircraft back and did. But I'd been over the top of a loop. And later on, somebody told me, and this is part of my ultimate life, that, you know, Gordon, that's very dangerous. He said, if you got on the top of a loop and you went into an inverted spin, in other words, you're sitting on the top upside down and you put on full rudder, in theory, and more about this later, you go into an inverted spin. Instead of spinning with the downwards, with the nose going around and going around, you're spinning the other way around in the circle. And to get out of it, you reverse all the procedures. A thing that I have never done in my life. But in America, all the boys who went to America training on steermans went through a situation with one instructor who did nothing else all day but show embryonic pilots what happens when you get into an inverted spin in a steerman. I didn't get into an inverted spin, but when I got down, I told that one of the Irks who looked after the engine, they said this, you know, I did a loop and I said, I got to the top and the bloody thing stopped and I didn't know what to do. I said, everybody tells me that, you know, you're going to fail. I said, oh, Gordon, he said, don't worry. He said, if you go up in a Tiger Moth and you have plenty of airspace, he said, take your hands and your feet off everything and don't worry, and it will come down in a stage, close the throttle, and he said, it'll come down where you just start the engine, it'll go again. You're doing the usual thing when you come out of a spin and you fly the aircraft. I knew this. I'd been told it. I never did it in a Tiger Moth while I was at Elmden. But later on, I did it, and it does work. I can assure you. So the Tiger Moth was basically safe if you had the right height and the right problems, and you knew what to do when something happened and not to panic. In the Tiger Moth, you don't do that, I can assure you, with high-speed aircraft like Hurricanes or even Spitz. I mean, you couldn't safely do that because you lost so much height when you were starting to spin and when you're out of control. More about that later on. So that was my first indication of what happens if you take chances and you don't know what you're doing. I had plenty of space. I was too cocky by half. But after that, there was no problem, because I still have that fault, even later on when I flew a steerman after flying high-speed aircraft, that I always wanted to fly around a loop. But with a biplane and a wing, you fly it round, obviously, you open the throttle, but you tighten it up to get over the top. Otherwise, you can't really fly it round because there isn't the power there. So that was an experience that's not given to many, and it was a salutary. And I still see going forward, when I went forward on my straps, and incidentally, when you go flying an aircraft under instruction or any aircraft, you always strap yourself in. All the time I was flying, for all those years, I never flew unless my straps were on and tight. Never, ever. Uncomfortable it was sometimes, but some people would take the straps off and sit in the large aircraft particularly, and it was easy to do. But you never know what's going to happen. And it's particularly indicative in the Navy, where people come in to deck landing, where you're coming at high speed, and if you come in with a firefly, for instance, with a cockpit open and everything else, and you have a gunner in the back, who has been wandering around in the back and hasn't lashed himself with his G-string to the bottom of the aircraft. And you come in to land and he has not got his G-string on. And you hit the wire and you're coming in at 80 miles an hour. The aircraft stops, but you don't. And you go over the top. And there are quite a few instances of people in Swordfish, particularly, where they've actually gone over the top of the aircraft and splattered themselves on the deck in front of the aircraft. That's again a solitary experience, and it's difficult to do. It's an easy option because when you're in an operational aircraft, you're sitting with all your bits and pieces on, and then with a parachute on the top of it, then your straps over the top of it, all pulled in tight. You're uncomfortable. You could move within that area, but you're limited in space. And one of the amazing things in this day and age where people go on long journeys and they talk about, this DVD where they get...
Thrombosis.
Thrombosis. But I do not recall ever having cramp in all the time I flew, which is quite something because you're sitting there. I was sitting there sometimes for 4.5 hours in a Swordfish where you're lashed in and you were sitting there with... an aircraft that you adjust the pedals, but there's always a need to keep a little bit of pressure on your pedals for 4.5 hours. But I don't know of any case of DVD either. But I think somewhere down the line, a lot of people, a lot of my generation who flew Swordfish were quite affected by this. And a lot of, and I have a friend who's a double amp now, where he's both, he got gangrene, maybe he's diabetic as well, but it is, when you think about it, we must have been incredibly fit. All pilots who flew single-engine aircraft must have been fit, purely and simply because they never suffered. I mean, to get cramp in a car is painful, but you can get out and walk about. You can't in an aircraft. I leave that. That's a transient thing, one thing. Anyway, we're back to first solo. We've done that. We've taken off into wind. Medium turn flying, gliding approach, and so that really is the essence of the training there.
Something you mentioned about if you had to leave the aircraft, obviously if it was on fire you'd have to jump out with your parachute.
Yeah.
Did you receive any instruction on how to operate the parachute during that period?
Oh yes, that was part and parcel of the ground instruction more than anything else. You were taught on the ground as well as in the air, exactly what happens when you pull a stick back, push it forward, what happens when you open a parachute, how it's packed, how you operate it, what you do, and bear in mind, the first time you do it, it's the first time. And I've never done it myself. I believed in staying in. But there were occasions when, you think you ought to have done, but... that's another thing. And all you did in a Tiger Moth was go out of this. If you've got an aircraft, if you want to get out of an aircraft with a parachute, you turn upside down, and when you're upside down, set the stick forward, and you're thrown out. And you're thrown out immediately, clear of everything, which is quite important. Otherwise, you roll over the side through the cockpit side, a spit particularly if you're flying straight and level. But obviously in a spit, if you have any sense at all, you turn upside down and push your stick forward. Easy. You can get so much speed, and when you push it forward, the pure effect of gravity and doing an inverted turn, in effect, the gravity just pulls you out of the aircraft. Then you count about six or something like that. Make sure you've got hold of the ring, and when you're ready, just give it a pull. I don't know about that, but that's what I was told to do.
Can you just describe for me, very briefly, because you've described a lot of the characteristics of the aircraft, but could you just give a description of what the Tiger Moth looked like? And
Oh dear. Well, it's just an airplane. It has a light engine. A very, very reliable little engine, by the way. What was it? It was, I can't remember. I put it till later on. But it was a very reliable aircraft with a propeller in the front. And you started the engine manually, no motors or anything like that, by a mechanic pulling the propeller blade forward. You gave him instructions from the cockpit. You said contract. You put your
magnetos.
No, the switches on the top. The what's your ignition switches, you know, on, put those on, say contact, and he flicked the propeller down, and hopefully it fired. It usually did, it was okay. From then on, you're faced with an aeroplane that is what everybody was used to in those days, the old Hawker Arts and everything else, with two wings, two wheels, a tail, made of fabric all the way through, a simple... One thing we haven't dealt with instrumentation, but there are instruments, of course. There was this airspeed indicator on the wings, which showed you roughly what speed you were doing. There was a pitot head, which is an air pipe, which goes to your airspeed indicator. And I have forgotten to mention that in front of you, you have your instrument panel, which shows primarily how high you are, which is merely a simple bar graph, which shows you in feet, which you adjust to the level above the ground all the time to make certain that you, if you forget to do it, you make a mistake, you're 500 wrong, you hit the ground sooner than you expect. But that's by the way. You adjust that, that's your altimeter. You have a turn and bang indicator, which again becomes part and parcel of instruction, which is, in point of fact, a dial with two fingers. One at the top, which moves from left to right through about 180 degrees, and the bottom, which does the same, the bottom. Now, to do a perfect turn, whether it's a medium turn or a high-speed turn, the bottom one stays at the bottom, at zero. It doesn't move to either side. The other one goes over as far as you want to, so that you're pulling away and keeping the... That's the essence. It's difficult to describe now. When you're set, go into it, these things move around. But when you know, you very rarely use them for flying afterwards. But it's always nice when you're flying, you look down and you turn the back indicator, show you're not side slipping or messing about with the aircraft. And it's almost automatic after that. Your feel of the aircraft will get you that one. Airspeed indicator, which is visually there. You can see where your limit is, what your top speed is, and any time, and you don't realise this until I've probably been flying a little, probably 15, 20 hours in a Tiger Moth, that you can tell by the feel of the aircraft when you're getting near the stalling speed, which is very, very useful. It's a sense. It's something you get, it's inculcated into your purely and simply conditional reflex. And you get that with every aircraft you ever fly. I don't know about the very, very big ones, but certainly I suppose the biggest one I ever properly flew was an Avenger. That was a huge piece of kit. And you can tell by the feel of the stick when you're nearing the stall. But it's so subconscious, it's unbelievable. So really you've got the basic instruments, which are turn and bank indicator, altimeter, so how high you are, turn and bank indicator, your speedometer to show how fast you're going through the air. What else is there? Well, those are virtually primary. Oh, a compass, of course. In a Tiger Moth, you only had a compass, which is an ordinary magnetic compass in a bowl, which is damped by liquids inside, so that you can find where you're flying in relation to due north, and you can set a grid on the top to fly if you want to fly in any particular sense. You can get it so that the line is on that. So, you know, basically, you use that at compass, which is not... You see, it's so long since I used the compass. But the compass in the aircraft, I think it was... Obviously, you had to look at it and adjust it somewhere down here. But also had, going further forward, but a gyroscope, which showed your actual position or course of steering against the datum of 0 to 360. I'll have to look at that. Well, think about that again, because... But it was very simple, very, very basic, but enough to know that you were flying. It's interesting that we're talking about 1942 now, and I was in Kenya later on, and I know Juanita Carberry, who was one of the crowd that lived in Kenya at that time. And the pioneer flyers were, for English flyers, were in Kenya. They were all flying by an ex-RAF, an ex-Fleet Air Arm pilot, who was a thug, but everybody had aircraft to get from A to B because it was quicker, and their flying development in Kenya was very, very fast. They could fly all biplane aircraft, land in the scrub, land anywhere, take off anywhere. Quite incredible what they did in those days, and that in itself is another development of flying which somebody look into.
Did you do Elmden? Did you do cross-country navigation at all as part of it?
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, forgot that completely. Once you've gone solo, of course, while you're doing this, you had a map to recognise points, and you one of the great big features of that part of the world were the two cooling towers in Birmingham, which you could see from miles away. That was always a focal point, and for navigation you had a map and you were able to identify things from the map. It's very difficult to recall exactly what we did learn about map reading, but obviously railway lines figured, water figured in it. One thing we've never taught, nobody ever taught, it was a bitter experience to find out later on, was the fact that ground is uneven. And you're told that there are mountains and you can run into them, but that's something else again, which I'll tell you about when I get to Scotland. But basically, we were taught how to read the map in relation to flying over the ground. I can't think of any particular stages of development, really. But we did a navigation exercise later on in the course. So we went through that precaution. It was in June that I did solo cross-country tests, and it wasn't until I was tested, I went to North Luffenham in June. So I started flying at the end of April, and I was doing cross-country runs in June, and I was certified that me has successfully carried out dual and solo cross-country tests, Bennett. My pilot.
Now, was that just with that? Was that the test simply that you got from point A to point B?
That was purely navigation.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in that period of time, obviously you're doing repetitive exercises, but they were grading and you're getting further and further and forward. And you did spinning, which was a fundamental. And that's a good practice to get into because it's the most likely unexpected thing that can happen to you when in your flying life at any time, okay, even when you get to the sophisticated aircraft. We were taught aerobatics, which we'll deal with in a second. We're also taught forced landings, taught precautionary landings, so you're in a situation where
I'm going to hold.